From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
After more than a decade of peaceful reconstruction, the Central American country of Nicaragua has seen unrest that began developing in earnest in April. Western media is only now beginning to report on it, and its causes are being largely misrepresented, as one might expect. To get the story from someone who's been looking at it up close and living in Nicaragua for a few decades, we spoke with a reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, from Managua, Nicaragua, via Skype Sunday. So we're going to focus on the area where you live, where you've been living for a long time, and maybe we could start with what's happening there right now in Nicaragua, and then some context of what's happened over the last couple of months.
And if we have time, I'd like also to talk about the way the media is being abused and exploited by the Nicaraguan opposition here.
Absolutely. That's part of the story, for sure.
And the news here is completely distorted, and probably the events that I'm going to describe now will be completely new to people because they're just not getting reported. So on let's go back on last week, Wednesday, May 30th was Mother's Day, and there was a big activity in Managua for peace organized by the government. But on the way down to Managua, a group of people that were going to take part in that peace activity were attacked at a roadblock just south of where I live. One person was killed and 27 were injured by opposition gunmen.
Gunmen?
They got shot. They were using firearms.
Wow.
A friend of ours who's a police officer was shot in the leg, and they fractured his leg. They broke his leg with the gunshot. A very serious incident, but that's just characteristic of everything that's been going on ever since April the 18th. And that simply doesn't get reported in the mainstream corporate media in North America and Western Europe.
Right.
So after that same day, at the peace demonstration, just as it was ending around 4:35 in the afternoon, opposition gunmen also attacked families that were taking part in that demonstration. And I think there were two dead, many injured. They, at the third attempt, they burnt down a Sandinista radio station called Radio Nueva Radio Ya, which is a very, very popular radio station and far from political. Most of its output is kind of music and popular entertainment stuff that people here in Nicaragua really enjoy. But because it's run by the government, the opposition gunmen and paramilitaries attacked it and burnt it down. And in the process, they also wounded 10 police officers and attacked the fire service units that turned up to try and put out the fire. So that's what happened in Managua. Then that same night, the opposition paramilitaries again attacked the municipal office here in Escalí. And in that attack, two people were killed and various people injured. One of the people killed was just a bystander, a guy from out of town who worked in a metal workshop here, just down the road from us. So at the same time, the opposition paramilitaries also attacked municipal office in Chinandega. Subsequently, they attacked the municipal office in a town south of Managua called Diriá. They attacked a government complex containing offices of various government ministries in León and burnt down three of the modules in that complex. And across the country, of course, they're maintaining their roadblocks, so people can't get around. They can't do the normal things that people do in terms of anything, economic life, commercial life, sorting out medical care, education stuff, and the whole national life is affected by these roadblocks, that the opposition media project as being peaceful, but in fact they're operated by delinquents, many of whom are masked and carrying firearms and other weapons.
I mean, these are some of the same tactics that are used when the unrest is excited in Venezuela, for example.
Well, it's a carbon copy. Yeah. Friends from Venezuela write to me when I tell them. They write and ask me, well, what's going on? I write and tell them what's going on. They write back to me and they say, well, this is a carbon copy of what happened in Venezuela all through 2017.
Right.
So, that's the story. Now, if you say, well, why is this happening? Where did this all start? It goes back to a conversation that we had maybe two or three conversations ago when the violence actually started back on April 18th, April 19th. But just as in the Ukraine in 2014 and in Syria and Libya in 2011, the pretext for the violence was completely spurious, because the violence and the protests had next to nothing to do with the claimed pretext, which was a government proposal for social security reform that was made in the days prior to, the weekend prior to Wednesday, April the 18th. And it was subsequently withdrawn on April the 22nd. So the pretext for the protests was completely cut away from underneath the protesters, but they continued their violent protests, and it became very clear that what we're dealing with is regime change.
Right.
This is nothing to do with social security reform.
That social security reform aspect, by the way, it's interesting, the narrative that they're trying to spin, that they're starting to weave in the media here. People that are ostensibly on the left claim essentially that what happened is that the government, by the way, is not really a leftist government. It's entirely in bed with the IMF and with all of the austerity and all of the things that go with that. And as part and parcel of an austerity package directed at the workers, they wanted to do pension reform, and that has provoked a leftist reaction from the students in defense of workers. That's the way that they're portraying it.
Well, and that's completely ridiculous, because the social security reform was actually in a measure that protected workers' rights. And what happened was that after something like 18 months, almost 2 years of negotiations at a tripartite process involving workers, employers, and the government, the employers withdrew. Why did they withdraw? Because the government proposal affected them more than it affected the workers. And that's the reality. And that's why the private business sector originally supported the protests. But now they're very sorry that they did, because the economy has gone down the toilet.
Yeah.
and they're the ones, the medium to large size businesses based in Nicaragua, are the ones that are most affected. And you can see that in the way that the major, the most wealthy interest, corporate interests in the country, continue to support the protests, because their income doesn't depend on productive activity here in Nicaragua. They've got all their money stashed away in hedge funds and foreign investments that protect their money.
Right.
They don't depend on the productive economy of Nicaragua.
Right.
Now, the leftists in North America and Western Europe, when are they going to wake up? This is the same model that we've seen everywhere. I mean, pick a country that's been attacked by the United States. It always starts with a supposed violation of basic civil and political rights. And then it rapidly turns into regime change, an attack on the government. And we've seen it time after time after time, and still the people on the left, who call themselves left, they even call themselves anti-imperialist, they still get it hopelessly wrong. Why do they do that? Well, I don't really know the answer to that, but my guess is, I suspect it's because they're so safely ensconced and comfortably ensconced in the corporate consumer capitalist culture that they claim to criticize, that they're incapable of actually seeing things for what they are.
Mm-hmm.
In places like Nicaragua or Libya or Syria or anywhere else, you know?
And well, anyway, you know, one way of putting that is that they are, trying to parse things on behalf of the working class from a petty bourgeois ivory tower.
Well, yeah, sure, and that's, yeah.
Yep.
And who are they to tell ordinary people in Nicaragua what their reality is?
That's right.
Anyway, and the situation here is that ever since the 18th, that on the 18th, those protests were legitimate. In my opinion, they were misguided, but they were peaceful and legitimate. And what happened was that government supporters, young government supporters, clashed with the students protesting against the social security reform. And as a result of the public order problems that those clashes provoked, in Managua in particular, the police intervened. And by all accounts, they intervened in a heavy-handed way. But there was no student massacre. That's a lie. One of the big lies about the events of the 18th is that there was a student massacre in which 40 students were killed, which is a downright lie. The first casualties of the violence were a Sandinista police officer, a Sandinista government supporter, and a standby, a supermarket worker who had nothing to do with anything. And that was the reality. And then, but the reality quickly changed because extremist armed groups from the extreme right-wing opposition, groups that are allied with people like Ileana Rose Lettinen and Marco Rubio in the United States, groups that have actively sought out the support of the anti-Cuban mafia in Florida and the most right-wing elements of the U.S. government. And those elements organized in a very efficient way, a very carefully planned way, the deployment of extremist armed groups that then attacked the police, and then mingling with the students, it was them that provoked the student deaths in circumstances that are completely unclear. And it just happens that we are a friend of the father. We are quite friendly, my partner and I, Luisa, with the father of one of the students that was shot dead in Esteli. Now, he admits that he doesn't know who killed his son, because there's testimony from young people that were involved in the protest that subsequently repented of their participation. It was a hired thugs from El Salvador that killed at least one of those students, and perhaps the second one too. But all that has to be established. And what the government has done is it's played by the book. It's called for dialogue. It suspended the measures that were the pretext for the protests. It asked the Catholic Church to intervene and mediate in a dialogue with the opposition, the very same opposition that was calling for the overthrow of the government and for the government to resign. The government said, all right, well, let's talk. And they asked the right-wing bishops, the ecclesiastical conference here of the Catholic Church, to mediate so that the opposition had no pretext to say, well, what's the point of the dialogue if there isn't a neutral mediator? And so the dialogue happened. The government invited the Organization of American States to send in a body to investigate the alleged human rights abuses, and that turned up the Commission for the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights sent a delegation that was here for 4 days, did a preliminary investigation, and came to conclusions very similar to the government's own Truth Commission. Both of them are saying, but the Inter-American Commission made its preliminary report about 10 days or so before the government commission made its report. And they said, well, there are 75 dead and around 800 wounded. That's what, 860 or something wounded. And then 10 days later, the government's Truth Commission said, well, what our findings are that there are now 85 dead and just under 1,000 wounded. So what's been happening is that it's the opposition that's been carrying out all the violence. And then they provoke situations in which ordinary Sandinistas and ordinary people that have no political allegiance whatsoever have to defend themselves, but then their media project that as Sandinista paramilitaries attacking the peaceful opposition.
Right.
No, and it's just it's astonishing how the media here, they come here inside Nicaragua, they're completely shameless in the way that they broadcast their lies. And for a long time, I didn't understand why are they telling such downright lies? Who do they expect to believe this? And of course, it's not for domestic consumption.
Right.
It's for foreign consumption.
That's right.
And so
American and European leftists, quote unquote, and anyone else who might try to hamper the United States from, you know, getting directly involved if they decide that's what they have to do.
Yeah, and just look at what's been happening. There have been attacks on municipal offices across the country. What's that got to do with social security reform? What's that got to do with peaceful protests? They burnt down municipal offices.
Well, this is what we were looking at. You mentioned Ukraine, Syria, Libya. I mean, these are the same things that happened, and they even accused in Libya, and some Libyan media, but mostly the world media, accused Libya of killing protesters from the air with airplanes, you know, of strafing protesters and such. And even when the Russians said, here's all the aerial photography of that location at that time, there's no airplanes.
Right. And so it might be helpful to look at some of the techniques that the opposition used. For example, they'll say, protesters have been refused medical treatment in the public health system, which is a complete lie.
Mm-hmm.
But why do they say that? They say that because they've already set up their own parallel health system, medical care, for opposition protesters that may get wounded or hurt in the activities.
Mm.
And so their wounds and what happened to them can never be verified.
Right.
So then they'll produce an AK-47 bullet, allegedly, from and of course the order here since at least the weekend of the 21st and the 22nd was for the police not to use firearms, not to fire lethal rounds, and so that just gives you an idea. So that that's one example. Another example is, for example, The media will say, oh, we're being attacked. There's a radio news station called 100% Noticias, which is rabidly anti-government here. And on the night of Wednesday the 30th, they claimed that they were being attacked, when in fact it was them that was encouraging the attack on the Sandinista radio station, Nueva Radio Ya. Yeah. So they claimed at about 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, they were being attacked. And a couple of people, government supporters, went over to take photos of what was happening, and there was nothing happening. There was no attack. It was a complete lie.
Jeez.
And so then other things that happen are that they'll use footage of their opposition paramilitaries attacking somewhere and setting it on fire. And then they'll say, look, these are the Sandinista youth. Look at what they're doing, destroying the country.
This is what they did in Caracas when they had the coup in 2002. There were pictures that supposedly showed Sandinista supporters shooting at protesters, except someone came up with a larger contextual picture that included the picture that had cropped picture that had been shown,
right.
And it showed, in fact, what was happening was they were being shot by the right wing death squad people.
And it seems very much to be the case that hired killers, either from Nicaragua itself or from Salvador and Honduras, have indeed been killing their own side. In order to, because what they need are martyrs.
Right, that's what they did at Maidan as well, right? And in Damascus too, as a matter of fact.
Right. So, and that goes on, and they pull all kinds of tricks to fool people in by use of the media. For example, there's an opposition TV channel here called Canal 10. Now, on the issue of the roadblocks, just imagine this, Don. Imagine if around New York, just say at the time of the Occupy Wall Street protests, Imagine if the Occupy Wall Street protesters had set up roadblocks around New York so that nobody could get in or out, and they were armed, and they were masked. And what do you think the government response would be? You know, and obviously they'd have called out the National Guard and shot dead the people trying to impose those roadblocks.
Well, all the Black Panthers did was advocate armed self-defense, and we saw what happened to them, and that was 40, 50 years ago.
Right. So, but here what's happened is that because Nicaragua's history is, it's only after over the last 10, 15, 20 years that a process of reconciliation has been able to overcome all the deep-rooted bitterness that was left over from the war of the 1980s and the insurrection against Somoza of the late 1970s. So the government here, and people generally, extremely sensitive to any threat of that kind of armed conflict. Anything that smacks of civil war is just abhorred here. Nobody wants to go back to that. And that explains why the government is bending over backwards not to send out the police, send out the army, and go in 2 or 3 days they'd clear all the roadblocks. You know, and they could easily put an end to the violence, but all that would happen is that the armed paramilitaries would migrate to an internal urban front, and they'd set up a rural armed front that would just continue to generate civil conflict. And that is exactly what the government is trying to avoid.
Well, you know, you have this condition of polarity that gets, you know, it's a historical legacy, and it's something that gets excited intentionally from Washington, you know, throughout. Just look at the United States even as a model of that now. And so what happens, though, the government in Nicaragua was masterful since Sandinistas won, you know, election after Chamorro, and done tremendous reconstruction and construction of the economy. Huge benefits to the people there, but they've done it successfully, including engaging the national bourgeoisie, and in the process. And this is something also that gets from so-called leftists in the United States, who could only dream of having that much power to even sit at a table with those people.
Right.
Is, you know, a source of deep criticism of class collaboration and betrayal and, you know, all of this nonsense, as if they don't know how to spell NEP, for example.
Yeah, no, and it's deep ignorance and deep kind of suburbia is the word, deep arrogance.
Yeah.
Because the Nicaragua's economy, and look at the global context in which the Sandinista Front came to power in January 2007.
Right.
What are they going to do? They're going to nationalize everything?
Right.
Give me a break.
Right.
So then what did they do? They set about democratizing the economy, and they've been incredibly successful in that. The associative cooperatives for small family business, micro business, that economy generates 70% of the employment here in Nicaragua. The business sector here in Nicaragua is not the main motor of Nicaragua's GDP.
Right.
The main motor of Nicaragua's GDP is in order, the popular associative cooperative family-based economy, which contributes over 50% of GDP, around 52-53%.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you've got government investment. And then after that, you've got foreign direct investment. Mm-hmm. And then well behind that, you've got the contribution of the country's private business sector.
Right.
So it's absolutely stupid and ignorant to say, oh, well, Danielle is in bed with the local bourgeoisie.
Right.
And it's just so stupid. And in terms of basic social, economic, and cultural rights. And this government has, and over the last 10 years, it's distributed over 100,000 property titles to people across the country. And in Nicaragua, indigenous people have 33, they have property rights to 33% of Nicaragua's national territory.
Wow. Wow.
Right? And remember that Nicaragua is the biggest country in Central America. People often forget that, although it has a small population of only 6.5 million.
Right.
That's because so much of its territory is a virgin forest or land that hasn't been exploited by the corporate capitalist system that dominates countries like El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. But and that's a whole other discussion. And there's the whole environmental discussion, of course. But the nitty gritty in terms of the economy is that this government has been, certainly in Central American terms, it is the most progressive, socially progressive government in the region.
Right.
And only Venezuela, Bolivia, and Cuba have social indicators for those kinds of things, like participation of ordinary people in the economy, access to basic health and education rights, access to property rights, land reform, all that kind of stuff. All those progressive issues that liberals and progressives and radicals of any stripe in North America and Western Europe should be celebrating, Nicaragua is a regional leader.
And they didn't start from that position. This has been accomplished since 2007.
Absolutely. They were lucky because they had the benefit of the enduring legacy of the revolution of the 1980s.
Right.
But they took office after 17 years of structural adjustment, Washington consensus, IMF and World Bank imposed policies.
And civil war, or whatever, the U.S. war.
Yeah. So then, and as you look at that, and then you try and work out, well, Why does the United States, why do they hate Nicaragua so much? Why do they want regime change in Nicaragua? They want regime change in Nicaragua precisely because Nicaragua represents a mortal threat to the neoliberal corporate capitalist vision of how countries should operate. Nicaragua isn't susceptible to the levels of pillage and looting that you see in countries like Argentina or Peru, for example. And that's why the United States wants regime change in Nicaragua. And there are a whole series of other reasons. And we can talk about the canal and the Interoceanic Canal and stuff like that. But that is the fundamental reason. And so the socioeconomic model that the Sandinista government under Daniel Ortega has developed over the last 10 years is the reason why the United States wants regime change in Nicaragua. Now, who are their local allies? Who are the allies that these leftists in North America and in Western Europe who criticize the Ortega government and align themselves with the protesters, who are the elements of that opposition to the government here? Well, first you've got Piero Cohen, the wealthiest person in Nicaragua, seventh wealthiest person in all of Central America, according to Forbes magazine. He's promoting the protests. So all those leftists in North America and Western Europe need to ask themselves, do we really want to be an ally of people like Piero Cohen? No, and then you've got Carlos Pellas, who's also an extremely wealthy individual with big sugar interests. And he's kind of essentially held a pistol to the Nicaraguan government's head because in the previous administration of the neoliberal administration, he extracted a concession, a tax concession or a tariff concession from the Nicaraguan government administration at the time, enabling his business to sell sugar in Nicaragua at more than the market price. Mm. I'm sure that was one of the reasons why the conflict began in the first place, because there's a tax reform on the table. One of the issues was going to be, well, will Carlos Pellas still get his sugar subsidy? Let those North American liberals and Western European liberals think about that.
That's right.
So then the other thing, there's so many things. I mean, that so you've got the business sector there.
We have to stop here, and we'll
so much to say.
Yeah, we'll pick it up, and maybe we can go into this again tomorrow or later on in the week, because there is a lot to cover. And Tony, thank you very much. We appreciate your time, as always.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Thanks.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.